District 32, Business Radio. Insights and inspiration. District 32, by today's business leaders.
Hi, this is Alan Cox from District 32 Radio. Today we're talking with Rael Bricker from railbricker.com. Today we're going to focus on the future of culture. So what do you mean by the future of culture?
The future of culture is highly related to the future of work. I often quote the old Peter Drucker saying that says, if culture ate strategy for breakfast, what's for dinner? And really it is about saying that companies into the future will need to define their corporate culture in such a way that it creates rich and robust cultures for the future. In order to do that, in order to add value to people that I talk to, I've gone out and taken my own experience out of two countries and two stock exchange listings to interview so far 82 different companies over 25 different countries, which will be the subject of my next book. But those interviews have really given me an insight into what companies are doing really well, what companies are doing to create robust and rich cultures. And interestingly, of the people that I approached, about just less than a third were actually working in toxic environments and wanted to tell me why their organizations were so toxic. And so when I started out, I thought I would only get the good news stories. And I was pleasantly surprised to actually get some real stories of toxic cultures that needed some dramatic work. And so it's been an eye-opening experience for me, and it's the stories that I share both on stage and with in my new book. That'll be part of the new book coming out next year. So what is it about? The future of culture is really about finding two things. The successful companies have done two things. They have found purpose and they have found values. Now, that's not a mission and a vision statement of a company. Those normally are laminated, stuck on the wall, and don't mean anything to anybody. Purpose is something greater than the company itself. Purpose is what the company and all its internal and external stakeholders relate to. And there's some great examples I can give you very quickly. The one is a software company that has 150 staff, and their purpose statement is three words. It says practical genius delivered. And I thought about that, and I thought it was fantastic that they could make every single engineer and every single support staff member in the organization look at that and go, wow, we're all part of this practical genius. We're all special. We're delivering something that's clever, practical, and actually delivered on time. That's the practical genius delivered. But if you looked at that as an external person, it wouldn't tell you anything about what they actually do. But it gave every single person in the organization a purpose with which to relate to the external organizations. That's a true purpose. That's a true statement of purpose. So what I've found is that successful companies have quite specific purpose statements. Not all of them have both purpose and values. Some have purpose statements that really bind the team together in their relationship with external people, like the practical genius delivered. And there are a number of other examples that will come out in the book and on the stage. When you get down to values, we had an interesting experience as board members of a school. We were meeting with a board member of another school who was telling us very excitedly that they had found a strategic planning partner and had gone through a strategic planning exercise, and they had come up with a statement of values for the school. So we said to him, great, what are your values? And he reached into his back pocket to take out a laminated card, and therein was the problem. Those values were long-winded sentences that were great and well-worded and articulate, but nobody in the organization could remember what their values were supposed to be. And so I came across a number of fantastic examples in my interviews. The one was a company that has offices in six countries, three English-speaking, three non-English-speaking. And already you can see the challenge there with trying to create a set of values that binds companies across six countries. And their value set was very interesting. It was five words. And the first word was fun. If you're not having fun, don't work here. I thought that was fair. You know, human resource policies in certain countries may not allow for that articulation. But nevertheless, that was the first of their values. We want people to be happy at work. And the second one was authenticity. You have to be authentic to our brand. If you don't have fun and you don't love our brand, don't work here. And then they brought it back to reality, because every business has to make money. And so the third of their values was accountability. So not only did you have to be fun, having fun and being authentic to the brand, you had to be accountable for your role in the organization. The fourth one, which is even weirder, was curiosity. And I said, why curiosity? And they said, because we don't want people to see themselves as an ivory tower. We want them to be curious about what everyone else in the organization does. And the fifth one was courage. So once you get to understand what your role is, what everyone else does, and you're curious, then you have the courage to stand up and make suggestions and make ideas and give the team ideas of how to make the organization better. And I thought that was a fantastic set of values that really every single person could remember those five words, and every person could embody those five words.
Yes.
And there's lots of examples in the research that I've done around the world of companies that have done that. I mean, a bank in South America that had to create values, but before they did that, they had to fire an entire layer of management because of corruption.
Oh, really?
Yes. So they actually got rid of an entire layer of management before they could even start the process of developing a set of values, because they wanted new people, new blood, without the corruption taint on it. So fantastic experience talking to all these people. So I guess the question is, that's great. These are what people have done in the past. Where to from here? And so from all the research and that I've done, and from all the companies I've spoken to, there are about 20 points. I'm not going to go through 20 now, but there are about 20 different things that companies are doing to create the workforce of the future. What these companies are doing ranges from employee engagement. So what is employee engagement? It's a common term, we use it. But what is it going to do for the workforce of the future? Well, let's start with our millennials, the bane of most of our existence. our millennial workforce are great workers. They love what they do, but they would love to start work at 10 o'clock in the morning. They want to work till 8 o'clock at night. They'd like to work maybe 4 days a week every third week and have some time off. They will work and give blood and die for the company, but 3 to 5 years later, they'll turn around and go, I'm leaving. I'm going to find another experience. Now, the workforce of today, the older workforce, has to understand that the average person under the age of 40 will change careers 5 to 7 times. So if you accept that, and you accept that you only have them there for a short period in your organization, but that they will do the best they can for that organization in that time, we have to change how we think. How do we create cultures for the future? Now, I've been speaking about culture a lot. Now, what is culture? Culture is a set of shared values, beliefs, and taboos in any organization. And everyone understands the values, beliefs, and taboos. But the other part that most people forget is that it's shared. Management often forgets that you can't impose a shared culture. The shared culture has to be developed because it's shared. By the nature of the definition of culture, it has to be developed from within. It can't be imposed from without. And so that's the other trend that we're seeing, is that companies are acknowledging that the actions of the team, the pride that the team have in wearing the company t-shirt, those are the things that are going to drive their culture to the future. The fact that we don't want 24/7 access to staff anymore. You know, when I was in my first job as an engineer 30 odd years ago at a major corporation in South Africa, I was told, be there before the boss and leave after the boss. That doesn't apply anymore. The fact that we do need to make sure our team gets time out, you know, that our team aren't checking emails at 11 o'clock at night, because that's the cultural norm. Those are the norms and the cultures that are going to shift as we move into the future.
And well done too.
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there's been a lot of work written about people living in major cities, so London, New York, Los Angeles. And just the stress of the commutes of an hour a day or an hour and a half a day means that 24/7 connectedness has to break. I know in the UK, for instance, most companies have 25 working days leave plus 8 bank holidays in an effort to try and build resilience into our workforce for the future where they don't feel the stresses of this. One of the other things that I think is a major trend and one of the biggest concerns for companies is artificial intelligence. You know, everyone's going to lose their jobs and robots are going to take over the world. Well, two sides to that equation. One is, I don't believe that AI will ever rule, because if we put a group of homogenous people, homogenous thinkers, and I've done this exercise many times, and I run an ethical exercise with them, they will all vote on different sides of an ethical exercise. So if a group of supposedly homogenous people can't make an ethical decision the same way, then how do we expect machine learning to do that? That's the first thing. The second thing is, yes, automated repetitive tasks will be automated. Like, that those jobs will go, but it's up to the organizations of the future. And here's the next critical element of the culture of the future: to create an environment of learning where people are happy to be retrained to stay in the organization. Because it's cheaper to retrain our team members than to employ new ones.
And even the millennials?
Yeah. I mean, that's a cultural thing, that they want to have different experiences. But, you know, we don't even know what jobs will be around in 5 years' time.
No.
Or 10 years' time. So a person starting a job today may be retrained in 3 years' time.
So that would be the new experience.
Yes, the new experience. They may stay on an extra 5 or 6 years because they've had a new experience and whatever. But the culture of learning and the culture of retraining needs to be embedded into the cultures of the future to create the future of work. And those are just some of the examples of stuff that's come out of what companies are doing around the world to create the future of work and the future of culture, so they can answer the question, if culture ate strategy for breakfast, what's for dinner? The book that I published in May last year that has a different title now, for a number of years its working title was Give Up Control to Gain Control. And it really came from my experiences in starting and growing businesses and then in some cases listing those businesses on the stock exchange. But it grew from analyzing how we actually instinctively grew the business. And what it was that initially, and every entrepreneur starts out like that. They start out doing everything, because to be an entrepreneur, most of the time you've got to be an A-type personality control freak. I'm one of those. Okay. And so if you're an A-type personality control freak, you believe inherently that you're the only one who can do anything properly. And the biggest revelation, and I was asked that in my mortgage business. So my mortgage business, I started in 2001. As at 2019, it settled just over $3 billion in mortgages. And I'm often asked, in the context of speaking about business, how did I grow? And I said it was interesting. At one point, I had 18 brokers, but no support staff. A few years after that, I had 8 brokers and 4 support staff, and the turnover was 5 times as much.
Wow.
And the reason was because we realized very quickly on that the job in that particular case of a mortgage broker, but it applies to any industry, the job of the entrepreneur, the job of the founder is to generate business, what I call the $500 an hour revenue tasks. The $10 an hour admin tasks can be done by somebody else. Now, obviously, when you're starting your business, you don't have the money to pay an admin person, so you do everything. And you work out probably the least efficient way of doing the admin, but nevertheless, it gets done in most people's cases. But suddenly, when you realize how much admin time you're wasting, and you could be paying someone $10 an hour, or minimum wage now is $20 an hour, you know, paying someone the, you know, minimum wage, even more than minimum wage, to do those tasks and give you the time to do the real stuff in the business. And so it is about a personality shift. It took a lot of self-control not to stand over the person's shoulder when I first employed my first assistant, who 13 years later is still with me and a partner in the business. It took a lot of self-control not to stand over his shoulder and look at everything he did. But as soon as I was confident that I had employed the right person, and I would sit with him and go, right, this and this and this are what you need to do. So I was still micromanaging, but I don't even do that anymore. I never, for many years, I haven't done that now. But it was a training process. It was a process of letting go of control. It was understanding that in order to empower your staff, so you go through your interview process, you make your decision, and you choose somebody, not because they're cheap. That's the wrong decision. You choose somebody because you think they're competent to do the job. Once you've done that, then you can't stifle them. Then you actually have to, I mean, in interviews, as crude as it may sound, I say to people, I'm giving you a piece of rope. You either pull yourself out of the water or you hang yourself. Okay? But that's what it is. And if you mentally, as a boss, as an entrepreneur, as a manager, have that view of your staff, that you're going to give them enough rope to prove themselves, or they have to get out the business, and then you give them enough rope to be able to do that, you'll soon learn pretty quickly who has it and who doesn't have it.
You're giving them the freedom.
You're giving them the freedom, and the freedom to come and ask the questions. And I think that's where a lot of entrepreneurs fall flat, is they employ someone, they task them, then they shut their door. And so, and as a manager, as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, you have to be present, but not working on the business. And I think that's a lot of mistake that people make, and I do a lot of time coaching and consulting with people in that space. It's about being present. It's about the team knowing that you're present, but not interfering. That's how you give up control and gain control. So you give up control of the day-to-day tasks, you gain control of your own time to generate revenue. And that is the one piece of sound advice I can give every business owner, every entrepreneur, is to find the tasks. And sometimes there is an exercise that we do where you actually have to diarize what you do in a month and then categorize everything you did for a month. It's real painful and it's quite confronting when you work out what you actually do. But you categorize everything you did into revenue or admin. And obviously admin, you know, as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, things like authorizing payments out the bank account, well, you want to control those. You know, that's the lifeblood of your business is your cash flow. So you control potentially the bank account, but you empower somebody else to go through the accounts and set them up and organize them for payment. It's not a complex task, but it's time consuming, and the amount of time you can use to generate business, it far outweighs the cost of employing someone. But it is a mindset thing.
Yes.
It's a mindset of trust. It's a mindset of saying, and you know what? If they mess up, so what?
So what?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, yes, in the mortgage space, we're dealing with people's biggest financial decision of their lives. And so there is a fear. Oh my God, what happens if they mess up? Well, so what? You know, the best thing I do is if I have to apologize to a client because a staff member has made a mistake, or I have to give a client bad news, I go into my open plan office and I make the call in front of my entire staff, because it's a good exercise to teach them how to do it. But more importantly is to teach them that it's okay to apologize. And most people don't get upset if you apologize and say, it's a new staff member, I was training them and they made a mistake, but it's fixable. We've got a solution, we've fixed it up. Obviously, if it's not fixable, then it is a problem and you could be sued and all the other things. But in the main, most clients are happy if you're honest. Honesty is a key value in our organizations. If you're honest and say, my staff member messed up, I'm busy fixing the problem, it'll take a few days, but it'll fix it.
You've been listening to District 32 business experts that educate and inspire. District 32 Business Radio Business Experts, 20 past the hour, every hour, Monday to Friday, on District 32, the power of connection.